You've stopped in at the Guidepost, brought to you by the American Saltwater Guides Association. Stock up on gear, grab a coffee at the counter, and get ready to hear incredible fish stories from the best captains on the East Coast and thought-provoking conversations with stakeholders and policymakers working to protect these fisheries. This podcast is presented by Costa Sunglasses. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Guidepost. Tony here today. I am super excited about our guest. I'm going to tell you a little bit about him, and then I'm going to let him kind of fill in the blanks here. But Mike Wilberg works for University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. As you well know, with the Guidepost, we embrace academia. We appreciate the work that they do, and we kind of see our job as a conduit so the great work that these researchers are doing in academia sees the light of day and people understand what's going on. So Mike and I have known each other for a while, and he told me a little bit ago that he was doing some super important work on striped bass in the Chesapeake Bay, and was working real hard to finish the paper and then go through the whole peer review process. And on, you know, a couple of days ago, a week or so ago, I got an email right before the striped bass hearing that said, "Hey, Tony, hallelujah, it made it through peer review." And I was so wrapped up in the striper and redfish and menhaden nightmare that befell all of us that this is the first opportunity we've had to get Mike on to talk about. So Mike, welcome to the show. Introduce yourself. Let's talk about your pedigree and what you research, and then we'll get into this specific research. And thank you for joining the podcast today, Mike.
Great. Thank you very much, Tony, for having me on. And it's really a pleasure to be here today. So my name is Mike Wilberg. I'm a professor at Chesapeake Biological Laboratory, which is part of the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science. I've been there for about 20 years now. My research is primarily on trying to understand how many fish and shellfish are in the ocean, what are sustainable fishing mortality rates. We do that with a lot of data analysis on my part. So I'm not the one out in the field collecting the data, but I'm the person who analyzes that data when it comes back in. I originally got my PhD at Michigan State University working on similar sorts of things in the Great Lakes. And as I said, I've been doing it here for about the last 20 years. And so I do work.
Mike, what was in your heart to pursue this career? And the reason why I'm asking is I think we have a lot of young listeners who may be interested in this type of work, and they don't know these jobs even exist. So tell us a little bit about your path before we get into the nitty gritty of this junk.
Sure. That was where I was for quite a while. I had thought that the only sorts of careers in fisheries were conservation officers growing up. And so I didn't discover this until I was about halfway through my bachelor's degree. And so I grew up really loving to fish. And so that's how I kind of got the hook. And I was generally good at math in school, and I liked it. And I also liked working with computers. When I was a junior in college, I was looking around for a new major because I was in journalism and didn't really feel like it felt right to me. And so I ended up getting a chance to go out with Michigan DNR doing some gillnet surveys that they were doing, and just thought it was the awesomest thing in the world to be able to go out and catch all those fish with nets that I'd never been able to use before and things like that. That turned into a summer job the next year. And I had to have, what I was doing was collecting, doing creel survey work for them. And I needed something for rainy days. And they're like, "Oh, we've got all this old data that we can't access. Can you do something with it?" Because they found out I like to work on computers. And after that, I was hooked. It was like I had 30 years of data at my fingertips that I was restoring, and I wanted to know how to use that. And then basically the rest of my training was in trying to understand how do we use historical data to understand our modern fish populations and sustainability of fishing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what a cool story. And I don't know why But in the past week or two, I was invited to my son's high school for Civics Day to give a talk about what I do for a living and, you know, how it positively impacts the community, Civics Day and all. And what I really tried to do for the kids was just give them a message that, you know, keep an open mind through high school and college and whatever's like that burning thing in your heart. And I think for each individual, it's different, but pursue it when you're young and see if you can make something of it, because the older that you get, the harder it is to go back and make changes. And right, you know, it is, you get one life. And if you think high school's a bummer, imagine having a job for the rest of your life that you hate. So it's, you know, it's really, I love hearing stuff like this. To me, that's what makes the best scientist, is when you have that passion and it starts with, well, I really like to fish, you know, those are the people who work late into the twilight hours, not because they have to, but because they love it. And I think that's where we get the best work from. So I'm super excited. I knew all this about you, but I you know, I'm glad the audience knows it about you too. So let's get into the meat and potatoes. You know, you sent me a paper last Monday on striped bass, and I think the audience is super familiar with this. You know, stuff always magically works out this way because we've been dealing with some natural mortality issues with other species. So they're kind of familiar with the terminology. They're familiar with what it means, you know, natural mortality, fishing mortality. It's like a seesaw, and you have to balance that seesaw to make everything sustainable. These are the two ways that fish and other things die. So you and your team have been doing some research on natural mortality of striped bass in the bay. Natural mortality, not fishing mortality, right?
Yep, exactly. And so what we did was we had a big project that was funded by NOAA where we were going to look at both how striped bass were moving up and down the coast, as well as try to estimate their natural mortality rates. And we were using all of the historical tagging data that's out there. And for striped bass, there's a lot of tagging that's happened up and down the coast. And we're talking about like the conventional Floyd tags a lot of people put in striped bass, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have probably caught striped bass with those tags in them. And so those tags get released since the early 90s. There's been almost 500,000 fish tagged, and we use that information to try and understand their movement and their mortality rates. And so for the natural mortality part that you were teeing up for me, the main thing that we found is that in Chesapeake Bay, we've been seeing an increase in the natural mortality rate across almost all ages. And by natural mortality, we mean pretty much all the reasons a fish can die that aren't due to fishing. But in the ocean, we're not seeing that same increase over the same time. And so our study, as you said, has just been accepted as covers the years 1990 through 2020. And so that's the time frame we're looking at.
So to kind of recap what you just said, you're seeing pretty much the same natural mortality rates in the ocean as we have seen over the time series, but you're seeing things that concern you a little bit in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah, absolutely. Those natural mortality rates have increased. They've maybe about doubled, maybe tripled over the last 30 years. And so it is definitely concerning to see that sort of increase.
You know, Mike, I always invite everyone to correct me if I'm wrong. And usually the line wraps around the building. But I think for the stock assessment, if I recall correctly, that the natural mortality rate in the Chesapeake Bay is 30%, I think.
It should be. The stock assessment has different natural mortality rates for each age. Mm-hmm. And the natural mortality rates that they're using are pretty close to the natural mortality rates we were estimating for the 1990s.
Okay.
But the stock assessment hasn't adjusted for increased natural mortality rates in the Bay. And so I'm trying to remember exactly what it is off the top of my head, but it's around 10% per year is the mortality rate that they're assuming for the older age fish. The younger age fish have higher natural
have a much
mortality
higher
rates.
Right, because everything can eat them because they're itty bitty.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, figuring you're probably not tagging really small fish. I mean, we don't say to do that, you know, because this thing's going to have a little itty bitty fish that has a, you know, big Floy tag sticking out of it, or one of the plastic, you know, just a plastic tag. I know for, you know, for other species, we do a lot of like coastal pelagic tagging for the Southeast Science Center. So, you know, everything from like cobia, jacks, Spanish mackerel, and we kind of drew the line on Spanish mackerel at about 20 inches, so it didn't hurt the fish. So when you're looking at these tagging studies, is there like a minimum size? And this directly relates to that natural mortality. So you're not saying that a 6-inch young of the year striped bass, you know, you don't have data on that because we're not tagging those fish. So what's about the minimum size that y'all are looking at for, you know, when this natural mortality kind of kicks in?
The minimum size we're looking at is probably like 12-ish inches, and so our study starts with fish that we think are about 2 years old.
Okay. And then up to about 8 years old when they finally like all leave the bay.
Yeah, up to actually all the way up as old as they get. So we have ones that are somewhere. We know they're older than 11, but they're pretty. They can be as old as they get, and striped bass have been aged to out to about 30 years old now, and so we know they can live quite a long time.
Yeah. So, you know, you're a scientist. You're a little bit subdued. My hair is falling out in clumps, and I don't have a lot to give because you just said that natural mortality could be 2 or 3 times what we're estimating. Is there a smoking gun, Mike? Do we know? Because, I mean, the ramifications for this, if this isn't in the stock assessment, you know, just, and I'm talking to the audience now, this means we probably have a lot less fish than we think we have. Is that, I'm trying to simplify it.
So the consequences of how it works out in the stock assessment are a little bit more complicated than that. When we underestimate natural mortality rates in stock assessment models, it doesn't it usually works kind of the opposite of how you would think it would. The stock assessment models are all designed around trying to match the catch that we think happened. And so if there's less natural mortality out there needed to be fewer fish to achieve that catch. And if there's more natural mortality, there had to be more fish to achieve that catch. So actually, what we'd be doing is underestimating the abundance a little bit, but still the model would be getting the catch about right. How that, because striped bass has different kinds of reference points than other species, it's unclear to me exactly how it'll work out in the final estimates. But one of my students who was working on this project is now the lead assessment scientist for striped bass. And so she's going to be bringing this information as part of the new benchmark stock assessment they're doing. And so ASMFC is fully aware that this research exists, and they're planning on using it as part of their assessment. And so, as you noted, it's just this is really hot off the press right now. And so it's just getting incorporated into the next management cycle.
So between this, Noah's little kerfuffle with the fisheries estimate survey and Mass DMF's work that we talked a lot about release mortality and other scientists' work on release mortality, there's going to be probably some pretty significant changes in what we know about striped bass in the upcoming year or so.
That's what I would expect.
I mean, it's pretty significant. I can y'all can't see
Yes.
Mike right now, but he's got like a Cheshire cat grin on his face. And I'm trying not to scare Mike off, but like basically everything's kind of tilted on the axis. And we And look, I'm not here to dump on anything that we knew beforehand. You know, you go back to the Diodati study in the mid-90s with striped bass. That's the best that they could do for release mortality. But when you have something as significant as this mass DMF research where it's thousands, you know, 8,400 fish recorded, you kind of throw out the old stuff. Especially when the paper says not to be used for management purposes on the bottom. You know, Mike's laughing again. So, but, you know, so this is not just like, hey, we're going to work this data in and it'll be a little tweak. It's like, no, this is the best information we have now, and it will replace the older information that, you know, the technology was not available. We didn't have the ability to follow a fish around the ocean. It was like you had to be lucky enough to catch a tagged fish and then just kind of jot everything down. And now we have telemetry tags, apps, where you can validate, you know, the size of the fish. And yeah, it's just, it is night and day. So that's my long-winded way of saying we can probably expect some pretty fundamental change in that benchmark in 2027.
I think so. I think there's a whole bunch of different things they're going to be considering. And I'm not part of the team that's doing that officially for ASMFC, so I don't have any real inside information on it. But I know that they're trying to turn over all the rocks right now, and they're just at the beginning stages of trying to collect all that new information before they try to figure out what they're going to do with it. But the team that's doing it includes members from all the different states that have important striped bass fisheries, and so they're well aware of that information, and they'll be trying to make the best use of it that they can.
So, Mike, let's get back to this paper. So y'all analyzed all this information and you noticed a switch, let's say somewhere around early 2000s, late 1990s. And is there a smoking gun? Is there, because, you know, when people hear this, you and I talked about it, it's one of the hardest things with science is like confirmation bias. Is you hear something and you're like, I knew it. It's the sewage treatment plant in Baltimore. And that's what's doing. It's the Conowingo Dam. It's dolphins. It's Bigfoot aliens. It's the multi-decadal oscillation theory. You're smiling again. And this is more my pain than your pain. Like, we try to bring something to the table and people are going to hear this and be like, we don't even need to manage striped bass. We just need better water quality and they'll take care of themselves. And it's not our fault. It's their fault. Please help me guide this audience. And Mike is not going to say something. Mike doesn't go out on a limb. You know, he's got his career, his students, his university, everything that he's representing. And what you're going to hear Mike talk about is measured responses, the truth, no wild theories, because that's who Mike is and that's what he has to do for his job. So everyone just take a step back, clear your mind, you know, and listen to Mike and accept what he's saying, because he steered, you know, this paper with his student, and we're trying to give you and everyone information to tell them what's going on and how this might impact everything. And we want you to hear it from the horse's mouth. We certainly don't want me talking about it. So Mike, you know, in all the work that you did, why do you think this is happening with all the possibilities out there? And, you know, what can we do about it as fishermen? Everyone who listens to this podcast wants to help. So take it away, good sir.
Yeah, certainly. So the biggest caveat is that our study wasn't designed to understand why natural mortality rates were changing. So I'm just going to put that out there first. The thing that we think, though, is probably most likely leading to increased natural mortality of striped bass in Chesapeake Bay is increasing rates of mycobacteriosis. And so several studies, including one that one of my students did that I was involved in, have documented that we've seen substantial increases in mycobacteriosis over the last, say, 20, 25 years in the Chesapeake Bay. And we suspect that that's what's going on. There's lots of other studies, or at least several other studies out there that say that striped bass that are infected with mycobacteriosis have higher mortality rates than those that have really background level infections or no infection. And so we think that's the most likely cause of it, but that's going to be a future area of study for that right now. In terms of what can be done about it, this is unfortunately, it kind of feels powerless from the perspective of an angler or fisherman is, well, what can you do about it when nature throws you a curveball? And the only thing we can do is basically try to respond to that and ensure that our fishery actions are still being sustainable going forward. And so if there's more disease out there that's affecting the natural mortality rates, unfortunately, the answer is it probably means there'll have to be less fishing in order to make sure the population can persist. And this probably won't be a permanent sort of thing. And so I have experience in working with
Mike, yeah,
oysters and
let's talk about this. Okay, I want to kind of tee up for this. So again, I'm trying to overcome the confirmation bias. Okay, so these are fish that are tagged all over the bay. And what I'd like to tell people, and Mike, interrupt me if I am wrong about anything. The whole goal of this is to be honest and transparent, and I don't want to fall into the confirmation bias that everyone else does. These fish are tagged everywhere in the bay. So it's not like these fish were coming from Baltimore Harbor, where we know the water's gross and we know it gets really hot. But there are certain parts of the bay that are absolutely pristine. And you know that, and I know that. There are beautiful areas of the bay. I mean, right now, today, where I live, man, I have like 6 foot visibility. That's not normal for the bay. Like, it's the fall. Yeah, there's a little cold snap and everything. But even this spring, I could see quarter-sized crabs walking along the sand in like 5, 6 foot of water. So that, you can't paint with a broad brush. You can't say, and you would agree with me that since the 90s and 80s, water quality has incrementally taken small steps and improved versus, are you in agreement with that as a
Yeah,
scientist?
absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I just, because everyone's like, it's so what? And you're like, dude, it's so much better than it was years ago. But yes, there are parts that are disgusting. And then the dead zone in the bay, just so everyone understands, there's actually something called the Coriolis effect, and it's the way the earth spins and its impact on like funnel-shaped bays like Chesapeake Bay and the Delaware Bay. We usually get saltier water on the east side, a little bit fresher water on the west side, because saltier water is a little bit heavier. It has to do with the rotation of the earth. And so that dead zone in the bay is really from about Annapolis to the Patuxent River, and it starts in about 20 feet of water. And it is the sediment, it is like the runoff and the nutrient density, and it settles down in those areas. And that process of that being broken down removes oxygen from the water. So the whole bay is not a dead zone, folks. Like, have I been wrong about anything that I've
No,
said?
I'm going to have you teach part of my marine biology class on
God help those
estuarine
kids.
circulation works. Yeah.
God help those kids. And look, I'm good at like three things, and because I'm passionate, I read a lot about it, because I just the more I understand, the better advocate I am. Science is brutal. Like, you can't just pick and choose. So in any event, what I'm getting at is when you have this number of fish that are tagged over this broad of an area, saying that the myco is because of water quality issues is not accurate. And we need to be accurate to properly address this, right?
Yes, definitely. We actually don't know kind of why striped bass have started to develop mycobacteriosis. They've gone and looked back at kind of archived fish tissue that they had to try and see, is this something that's always been there that we didn't notice, or is it a new phenomenon? And they first started seeing signs of it in the mid-1980s. Mycobacteriosis actually causes a whole bunch of different sorts of diseases worldwide, or Mycobacterium does. There's a whole bunch of different species of it. It affects all different kinds of both terrestrial and aquatic animals. And so it's a pretty common phenomenon. We think there's several species of Mycobacterium that cause this issue, but we don't know what's driving why they make an infection worse
So,
or not.
y'all heard it from the scientist. This is the guy that did the research. They have like everything from tissue samples to 500,000 stripers that have been tagged, for the past couple of decades. So it's you can't just jump up and say climate change. It's because the water's warmer. That's not true. They don't know that. You can't say water quality. And I guess what Mike is saying is the one thing that we know, well, the one thing we kind of know is that natural mortality is a lot higher in the bay. We think it's a new strain of myco. And this is where I would kind of want to dovetail this into other species in the bay that have had diseases that Mike has worked on. And one of them, I think the flagship species for that, and we're kind of on the other side of this curve with these, is oysters. And oysters had two diseases that were attacking them in the bay, and it was MSX and it was dermo. One was a little bit in fresher water, one was a little bit in saltier water, but they were lethal to oysters. And the way that we ran our oyster fishery a while back, over 10 years ago, was actually spreading those diseases from where they originally planted the oysters to where they moved them for harvest. And it was just terrible what was happening to these shellfish. And Mike did a lot of work on them. And I guess what happened over time is like only the strong survive. And those oysters started, the ones that survived started developing, a herd immunity. I think we're all familiar with that terminology. And that's all I'm going to say about that. But they started developing an immunity, and now we have a growing oyster population in the bay because over time, I mean, look, I would be willing to guess that before humans were scientists and before humans were fully exploiting all this stuff, this was a regular cycle that diseases attacked some species in the system. And over time, those diseases became less virulent. And there was a natural immunity, and the species got over the hill and came back, right, Mike? I mean, that's just how things is in nature, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Populations have always been bouncing up and down in terms of abundance, and disease is one of the things that drives that. And so, as you said, for oysters in Maryland, anyways, in the mid-1980s, we had a really bad disease event that killed, we think, about 75% of the oysters in Maryland. We had that same thing happen again in the early 2000s. But since then, we haven't had a really severe disease event. And for basically, the oyster diseases are at their worst when the water's really salty and when there's a drought. And now, when we have really salty water and when there's a drought, we get less disease. And from that disease, we get less mortality than we used to. So we haven't had a major disease outbreak in oysters in Maryland in like the last 20, nothing like we've seen from the like 1999 to 2001 sorts of things where,
So
like I said, 75% died.
can you kind of make that connection on a very basic level with what you're learning about stripers, like what we learned about how the oysters, because I don't want people to think this is like the end of days. If it is myco, it's not like we can't overcome this. I try to give people hope in all of this. So it's not, a lot, I don't want to be doom and gloom every day. So like, what did we see with oysters and how does that tie into potentially just, you know, the way that nature works with striped bass.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, as you said before, it really is this idea of survival of the fittest. There's every striped bass is an individual. They respond to disease differently. And the ones that survive are the ones that are most likely to spread their genes on to the next generation. And as that happens over time, that's the evolution where striped bass will respond to disease. And so my expectation would be that in the future, disease effects will be worse. I don't know how long it'll take us to get there, but that would be how I would expect it to go, because that's the common trend for diseases generally. And it can happen both because the striped bass are developing resistance, but also the disease organism is changing too. And so it ends up being really complicated how this all ends up working out. And it's something that's also very hard to predict.
So again, I think knowing is like 3/4 of the battle, you know, getting this information into the stock assessment to me is the critical part, because, you know, you can't say you have 10 acres of apple trees when you only have 5, right? And if we know that this is happening, and the FES, and the release mortality, and everything else, it's a little scary, right? I've done my best to not, you know, add stuff that's not helpful. But when you look at this, I think the one baseline that's kind of never been wrong is the Maryland Young of the Year. And we know that the Young of the Year hasn't been good the last 7 years. And then you see this, and to me, that's kind of like almost like a 1-2 knockout punch. If there are very few fish that are coming out of the spawn for 7 years in a row, you know, let's just say way less than half the average or the mean, does this add another level of concern into the mix?
Absolutely. Low recruitment is always a problem for fisheries, because again, like it goes back to what I said before, fisheries management is kind of always playing out the hand that nature deals you. And having low recruitment just means there's fewer fish out there for everybody to share. And nobody's generally happy about that situation. The other thing that our other study on myco has shown, though, too, which was a little bit of a surprise, is we're starting to see myco in age zero striped bass. So those really small ones, even, we're seeing evidence of myco in. And I am quite curious whether that's playing a reason why we're seeing low recruitment in recent years.
Could you go one more level down on that, Mike, just to help me understand what you just said and everybody else?
So, previous studies didn't really ever detect myco for the youngest ages of striped bass. They just had generally seen the pattern that as you get to older and older striped bass, a higher and higher fraction of them test positive for myco when you look at it. And so it gets up to when they're like age 10, we're looking at like 50, 60% of them test positive for myco if you take their spleen out and look at it under a microscope. And so what we're seeing in our most recent myco paper is that we're also seeing a unexpectedly high fraction of just young of the year striped bass, so the ones that hatch this year, that test positive for myco.
Well, crap. Like, that's kind of terrifying.
Not, it's not good, no.
We're seeing very young fish with myco. But when we had the conversation last week to set all this up, you had mentioned that you, in aquaculture, other environments, if a fish gets up myco, it's dead. But you don't think 100% mortality with myco, but you don't think that's the case. Because people are hearing you say 50% of these fish have myco. So I just want to put a fine point on that.
So most of the fish that have myco have a really mild case of it. And for those fish, they have about the same mortality rates that we think uninfected fish have. And so the mild cases, which are most of the fish that are positive, are it's not really affecting them, or at least we don't think it is. It's the little bit of severe cases that are out there where they have much higher mortality rates once they get to that severe stage. And so those are the ones that are the problem. But the majority of fish have it. They have it throughout their life. Once they get it, we don't think they can get rid of it, but they might live their whole life with just a mild case of myco, and it might not really ever affect them. That's the part where it's a little bit, you get to the edge of our understanding of how this disease is really working in the fish, but just based on the how, what fraction of the fish test positive and things like that, I don't think that they're the ones that have the mild infections are dying at really high rates. And so it's not like it's a death sentence for them to be positive for myco.
Now, we talked about this, and this is entering into the land of anecdotes, but we very rarely see the outward signs of myco. I'm not suggesting that if you cut the fish open and looked at its spleen, it wouldn't have the little nodules on it, but we don't. I guess what I'm saying is we see maybe those lesser cases that, aren't like a leper fish that you look at and you're like, I just want to kill it to put it out of its misery. Like it's not going to live much longer. In the shallow water where there's, I think, more abundant food, more variety of food, more wave action to oxygenate the water versus like deep water fish that hold on to structure like reefs or bridges or current breaks, bars. We never see those kind of in-stage infected fish in the shallower, prettier, cleaner, marsh areas where there is more food, more wave action. We usually kind of see them in the open water of the bay. And we talked about that a little bit, and I think it kind of got your science juices flowing. But that's not saying that those fish in shallower water don't have mild infections. I mean, I think it's just really impressive that y'all have gotten to this point, you know what I mean? Like, and I appreciate your honesty on, hey, we don't know if they all die or not. You certainly don't think all of them die. So, in all of our conversations last week, and we're going to have you on here again to talk about another research project on striped bass that we've, and I'm not even going to touch that with a 10-foot pole right now. We're going to get you on after. But one of the topics that came up with you and I was that for a long time, as long as I can remember, I mean, well, I guess this first probably came up in 2010, 2011, when we had gone to two fish and the stock assessment said you're going to be in bad shape in, by 2017, and we were supposed to take a big reduction. We're supposed to take like a 38% reduction. And we ended up taking like under a 20% reduction for the bay. So we had assumed that a lot of that we were fishing on predominantly male fish in the Chesapeake, and some of your research has disproven that.
No, I don't think so. Unfortunately, there's very little data that's collected on the sex of fish. And so for the marker capture study, everything is all aggregated together. Generally, what the patterns are from a bunch of the other data sources are that there's more older females than there are males. And in general, the idea we think is that striped bass have to kind of hit a critical size before they start migrating out in the ocean. And the males do just grow slower than the females do, and they never get as big as the females on average anyways. And so yeah, there are still the we think there's more of the older males that hang around the bay than the females.
I remember a long time ago, or late 90s, it was totally common for us to catch fish over 35 inches. And we all knew in the middle of the summer, not in the spring. And we all knew that that was some kind of crazy old male resident population that never really got, you know, you wouldn't catch like a 45 inch fish, but you would catch your fair share of, you know, these kind of rough and tumble 32 to 35 inch fish. And we had a lot of them, and they're gone now. We don't have those anymore. Shocker.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Yeah. And it was always, you know, it was kind of one of those old wives tales that were like, that's it. Those are our big boy males in, you know, that's a resident population that really they don't migrate. They just kind of stay here. And in any event, you know, stories of yesteryear that few people believe, because of shifting baselines, you know, right. So, you know, Mike, I mean, is there anything else that you want to add to this research? I mean, we appreciate you sharing everything with us. You know, I sure as heck learned a lot. Really happy to know that this information is going to go into the benchmark. Anything I didn't ask you as an interviewer, anything that you want to add?
The one other thing I do want to add is that we don't think that Myco is being driven by not having enough food. And so we don't have evidence that...
More confirmation bias, Mike.
Yeah. And we don't have evidence that striped bass aren't getting enough to eat. And in fact, it does look like striped bass are getting plenty to eat. And it makes a lot of sense. There's a lot fewer striped bass out there now than there were before that are...
Yeah, there's not as much competition for...
Yeah.
The food supply. So yeah. We don't think this is a water quality issue. We don't think it's Bigfoot. We don't think it's because they're starving.
Yep. The myco is worse, or does appear to be worse anyways, in years that are hot and in years where we've got a big dead zone. And so basically the bigger the dead zone, the kind of that corresponds with more fish being positive for myco, okay, as well as warmer waters correspond with that. And so that also makes sense. These are things that stress fish out. And if you're stressed out, the immune system isn't going to work as well. But we don't know if it's basically a cause or an effect. That's whether it's the lack of oxygen and temperature causing it, or they just have it and it exhibits worse in those bad conditions.
Holy moly. Well, so basically to round this out, there could be a new strain of myco. And it could be bad for the next couple of years until there's some kind of herd immunity or only the strong survive. And there's all this stuff going on. We don't know if it's cause or effect. The only thing we can really do is control how many fish we're taking out of the system through fishing.
Unfortunately, yes. I wish I had a silver bullet that I could say and just make it all better, but unfortunately that's usually not the way that at least my kind of science works. My family likes to say I'm not a useful doctor, which is often the truth.
They say goodness, they say, my family says a lot about to me too, Mike. Don't take it too seriously. They need you, they love you. So man, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being on here. It's just, it's one step beyond something that we just need to be aware of. I mean, this is serious stuff. And anything that you put out there, we automatically respect and want to learn more about. You know, it's your generation that's going to lead us, you know, for the next couple of decades. And, you know, we're a science-based association. And we appreciate all the work that you and your students and your peers are doing. And we want to, you know, we want to climb the highest steeple and sing this stuff because, you know, we need all the ammo that we can get so these fish are truly managed under the best available science. So from our conservation community to your science community, we appreciate and respect everything that y'all are doing. And hopefully it's stuff like this and stuff that MassDMF is doing and that'll kind of help us understand and recover this species as quickly as possible. So, you know, future generations can enjoy them the same way that we did. And I think that's really important. And I bet your 19-year-old self is would be proud of you today when you switched. You probably would have been a crappy journalist, Mike. I'm just saying. I would have.
It would have been a horrible career choice.
I think you found the right one. We love you and respect you and appreciate everything that you're doing, man. And thank you for hopping on the podcast.
Certainly. Thank you very much for having me, Tony. And it's been a pleasure talking with you.